welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Podcast. Today we have a fabulous director, producer, writer. This my man does it all, but we're going to get into it today. Asif Akbar? Asif?
Yes, you got it.
Okay, I'm trying here. Welcome to the show. You are like a renaissance man of filmmaking. You do it all.
Yes, thank you for having me here, Simon. I'm glad to be here and chatting with you. And I've gotten my feet wet in a little bit of everything in this industry, in the film industry, since I was very young. So I've been very fortunate and blessed to be where I am today and doing what I love.
So let's discuss. I was doing some reading on you, so I want everybody to know I had to read up on this guy. And there is lots to read out there, so please don't believe me. It's all out there. Go look.
Okay.
It says a lot you were inspired by your father, so help me out there. Is this what drives you to be who you are today?
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with actually the support I had from my father since I was a really young kid. I mean, and he's had a little bit of experience in the movie industry and theater back actually in Bangladesh, where I'm originally from. And, in my culture, in the South Asian and, in a lot of cultures, not even just in the South Asian culture, but, growing up here in the United States, our parents and family, they have, a lot of ambitions for kids. And they always, ask you, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? And they try to push you to be a doctor or engineer, or a lawyer, the stereotypical the professions or going into business. But for me, it was always film. I knew I had a passion for film and TV. And I always knew ever since I can remember as far back as 2 years old, one of my earliest memories, I remember knowing that I wanted to make movies and things that I watched on TV that inspired me from a very early age. And my parents, both of them, supported me really well. They let me watch whatever I wanted. And I don't know. I mean, I guess it was a good thing. I was very open. I mean, of course, they didn't let me watch like really bad stuff, but I'm talking about like Jurassic Park when I was 3-4 years old, and
wow.
Terminator when I was like 2. They opened my mind to where it didn't affect me in a negative way, but it made me explore stories in my own head and understand the concept of what it takes to make a movie. And my dad was involved in acting when he was younger. So when he saw this spark in me of interest to, go and do something creative and, involve myself in entertainment, he was one of the only ones in my family that really mentally supported me and said, look, you can be whatever you want to be, do what you want to do. You have my support. And my mom was always there, but she was kind of iffy about it. Like, she wanted me to obviously have a real profession where I, you had a study and then something more guaranteed. But throughout, as I was growing up, 7, 8 years old, I started joining, youth theater groups, and I started writing my own stories, like little, children's books and just the stories that I would even carry on from my favorite movies, and take the characters. And then around 10 years old, I started making my little, home movies with a camcorder and my friends, and we would do the tape-to-tape editing. And so I started turning some of my scripts into actual, movies, little short films that I was making at 10 years old, 11 years old. And that inspired me more to just keep it going. At that time, I didn't really think like, oh, I'm going to be making money off this and making a living and career. I just did it because I loved it, and that's all I knew. To me, I wanted to be a cop. I wanted to be, in the military, or wanted to be a doctor. And I saw actors portray all these different roles in different movies and have fun with it. And to me, that was fascinating. And I said, okay, I want to be an actor. At first, I thought being an actor was really making the movies. And then I started, you know, going into acting when I was a kid. Around 12, 13 years old, I started realizing, like, look, you know, when you're an actor, it's great, but you're pretty much a pawn to someone else's story, which is the director, writer, and the filmmaker. So I started shifting, you know, and naturally to me, I was already kind of used to the concept of how a film's put together because I was making my own little short movies. And then in high school, I was lucky enough to be involved in a vocational program in my high school, which, you know, the school district supported the arts a lot where I grew up in Parma Heights, Ohio, at the Parma school districts. They supported different career programs for kids. If you want to go into auto or medical or, you know, entertainment, you had these vocational programs for the last 2 years of, you know, your high school years, which is the junior or senior year. So I went in my junior year in this program, and I was already from the first week directing my own content and learning how to use the cameras, the professional grade cameras and editing systems. I learned how to edit on Avid, you know, when I was 15 years old. And the Avid is one of the hardest linear editing programs out there. And so this was like 2005. And I started advancing, and we actually, our class worked. Sorry, can you hear me? Sorry, there was a glitch. Okay. Yeah, so our class actually worked with the local TV stations, you know, Cox Cable, to put on shows. And so I would make programs for that. And then at 16, I directed and produced my first TV show, which was a fitness show called Fit for Life. It was on international satellite stations and on Channel I in Bangladesh, where it aired. And I did 13 episodes of that. And from there on, I knew that I wanted to be a filmmaker and I wanted to work more behind the scenes. And I would still do acting off and on. I've done some TV work in Bangladesh where I also was able to be hands-on in the edit room, watching the editors, you know, edit the shows together. And to me, it was just, that was it. I knew that that's what I wanted to do. So after high school.
Hold on. You're going way too far. I want to back up a bit.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, you're doing great. I got a question. The handy cams, do you still have that footage?
I do, actually. My parents, I believe, they live in Louisiana, and they may have, I haven't been there to look in years in the storage, but I believe they have the only copy of the VHS film that I did then, and I was 11 years old, and it was 50 minutes long. It was a 50-minute long movie. It took us 7 months. My friends and I did it after school and during weekends, and at the time I used the tape-to-tape editing to edit together. So I believe they do, and then one of my other friends, Max, who was in it, he had a copy. So it's been years, you know. But I have other movies since then that I've done, like even when I was a kid.
I want to go back. Okay. You did mention the TV show that was showed internationally.
Yes.
No, I couldn't find – I want to be shocked. It's not on your Wikipedia page, and I found nothing about the TV show. So
yeah, it was a very small – it's I think there's like a promo of it on YouTube. It's called Fit for Life. It's Fit with the number 4, Life. And it was kind of an interesting concept. I tried to blend, you know, two sides of the world together in the fitness world. And I was into fitness in my high school years as well. So I wanted to kind of blend the two worlds that I loved so much together. Because I, you know, I used to play sports. I spent a lot of time in the gym and working out. And I made a lot of friends. And then at that same time, I was going back and forth from here in Bangladesh doing some TV work there as an actor. So I figured, okay, I would blend the two resources and contexts I have from both places. And so I started filming different trainers that had like 4 different methods of fitness, you know, from bodybuilders to just people that want to just work out to be fit or be athletes, whatever it is. And so I started having trainers here that I would film like 4 or 5 hours a day. That I, you know, acquired a lot of footage and a lot of different segments from here, then I went to Bangladesh and I spent about a month with different gyms and different trainers from, you know, a different side of the world doing the same thing. And then I blended it together to have different segments. Okay. It was kind of interesting for its time. And I learned a lot doing it. It was a lot of fun. And I just kept going from there on. I made another movie with kind of similar, you know, concepts. So, and I'm still doing it today. Like in some of my movies, I'm blending a lot of the different worldwide resources I have.
Your first film was a 45-minute short.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that was the film I was talking about when I was 11 years old and yeah, that I completed.
Okay. Did you submit it to film festivals or did you do anything with it?
Well, no. At that time, you know, I didn't think anything of it. I just made it to show friends and family, really. And my school, I remember at the time I was in, I finished it. I started when I was in the sixth grade, like beginning of sixth grade. I ended up finishing it end of sixth grade and then didn't show it till like my first month in the seventh grade. And my teachers saw it and they're like, look, we have to have a screening of this. This is great for, you know, your age. And they inspired me a lot from there too. They said, you have to go out to Hollywood. You got to be doing this for, you know, your career. So from there, they did a screening at my school for like the entire seventh and eighth grade classes to just kind of show them, look, this is what one of your, you know, fellow classmates did. And so that was really cool. That was inspiring. So that's like the biggest thing that happened with that movie. And since then, you know, I just had like two VHS copies. I never thought like ahead with it. But then, you know, I just went into making more stuff. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to make something better. You know what I mean? And but now thinking back, it's one of those things I regret of not having more copies and not really putting it up somewhere. But yeah, and at that time, YouTube wasn't even really that big. It was just coming into play, like I think a couple of years after that. So I, you know, we weren't really savvy with all that stuff.
So do you still have a copy of this one?
Well, that's the one my parents, I believe, have. So next time I'm there, I'm going to try to dig it up. So that's
yeah,
the
we
one.
Need to
I
dig
do
it
have up. A copy of one that I made after that. It was called Swevin. And that was more of a feature length. That was like 90 minute. And I was 16 when I made that one and completed it. It was like the same type, same concept.
16 years old. And you
yes.
realize at this time you need to make an hour and a half movie.
Yeah, and that one actually I made to do screenings, and I didn't put it in film festivals, but I did have different screenings in the community, and I did a screening at my school for charity at my high school there, and we had like 500 people show up, so yeah, that was cool, and that is something I do have copies of that on DVD, and it was called Swevin. It was like a psychological thriller.
Let's go back here. Most 16-year-olds are not making films.
Yeah, maybe nowadays with the technology, I see more younger kids getting into it with apps.
Well, how does it feel to be 16 showing a film to 500 people that you don't know?
Well, I mean, that was – I felt – because I was also in sports, so I kind of felt like it's something similar to, like, sports. And even I was in band, and, you know, I've always kind of been a performer since I was young. So to me, it was always, like, natural to be able to, like, show or perform something for an audience. But at that time with the film, it's definitely a different experience. It's you know – to me, at that time, I kind of had a feeling of what it felt like to be a director to show your own child, like your baby. Like, you know, it's different with sports and music, where it's not like a real creation from within you, you know, and like with film, it's hard to explain, but, you know, now I have a kid and I kind of get it. It's not like the same love, but it's still like the same feeling about what people are going to say or think. Or, you know, if you look stupid or not. But at that time, I realized that it didn't really, I wouldn't want to say it doesn't matter. It really does matter what the audience says. That's our number one priority when we make it. But at the same time, I realized, I guess what I should say, rephrase it, is I realized that it's okay what the audience thinks, whether it's good or bad. You know, you can always have 50-50 or, you know, whatever. You can't make everyone happy. So at the end of the day, you just have to do your best work. And at that time, I thought, okay, you know, this is the best I could do with the resources I have. And it actually, you know, went farther than my expectations. And so I learned at that time that as long as you just do your best, you will have something better than you expected. You know, so I carried that on to always trying to just do my best in every project I have with the resources I have. I don't regret like, oh, I don't, why don't I have this much money, or why don't I have, you know, that or this actor to do it. If, you know, I try to make it work with what I can and do my best with it.
So I've read a lot. You work in Bangladesh, which you've also said you work in Bangladesh, and you obviously work in the USA, and you probably worked in other countries. So what's your favorite country to work in?
Well, I would say, I mean, definitely here in the States. Most of my resources and friends and colleagues that I work with have been here. But I will say it's always a unique adventure to go to different countries and especially travel with the film family that we have here, because, you know, over the years, and I've established my career in LA and Hollywood, over Bangladesh. And that's what I wanted to kind of, not really, you know, put myself in a hole with is be known as a Bangladeshi director, because I've only produced, one Bangladesh film, and I've acted in a couple Bangladesh TV programs when I was younger before I became a filmmaker. But for me, I was always going to be a international filmmaker or Hollywood filmmaker that made movies for a bigger audience and larger audience, not just the Bangladeshi audience. So for me, I've always loved blending different cultures and different countries together in productions and creating a bridge where people from all walks of life can work together and create something unique. And that's something I learned from working in both places and in other countries and being in a multicultural, you know, environment from a young age. I felt like, and I still, you know, believe that, and I share this with a lot of people in the industry, it's always best to collaborate with you know, people from all over the world, because they're all bringing the best of where they're from. And film is the most collaborative art form, and that's what I love about it. And some people don't realize that, you know, sometimes directors are like, oh, that's my movie. But it's in reality, it's a teamwork with every single person, no matter whether you're a PA or a producer, director, or, you know, production designer. Everyone does their part and has to do their best to make it the best movie it can be. You know, so to me, that's what I love the most, is working with people from all over the world. Like when I have a team go from here and work in Bangladesh, or, you know, we go to Thailand or wherever. It's blending those cultures and the people together, and to see the magic that comes out of it, you know, and that's what's really fascinating. It doesn't matter now where we shoot the film. It's about the people you work with.
Okay. So you do writing collaborations with people.
Yes.
From what I've read. So how is different from you? So do you like to come in with a set script of some kind, like obviously not fully fleshed out? Or do you like to go into your meetings, hey, this is what I'm going to talk about, this is what I'm looking at, what idea, does this work for you? Or do you have something ahead of time? How does that work for you, your process?
I started off with having scripts ahead of time, but nowadays more I go in with more of the concept and the ideas, and then if we see like that's something that will work, or the studios want to take a bite at it, and we have some sort of a minimum guarantee, and then we work off of those to adapt to what we need to, based on what actors we have to put in, where we need to shoot it, you know, what kind of budget we're going to end up with. So we adapt to all those elements and make it work. And a lot of times, you know, I work very closely with other writers or I'll do it myself. But I'm always open-minded of the script changing throughout the entire process of production and even in post, where we have to re-edit things and reformat storylines. But I'm very open, and that's something that a lot of the actors I work with love in our collaboration, is I'm always adaptive to changing the script as we go. On the spot, sometimes I'll write a new scene as we're shooting, like half an hour before, and I'll sit with the writers actors, and we'll come up with something, and then I'll write it down, and then we work with that. And that actually sometimes ends up being better than what was originally written. And for me, you know, I love that process of also not really knowing what we're going to have until we have it in the can, you know, because sometimes you can tend to block yourself in and corner yourself to one specific idea. And in the practical world, what you write on paper months, you know, earlier may not work. And most times it doesn't work. You know, you have to rework things. When you're writing a scene and you're thinking the dining room is going to be separate from the kitchen, and all of a sudden you get to the location you have where they're both together. You have the dining room and the kitchen. So how do you rework that scene? So there's a lot of things. Recently we got snowed out. Where we couldn't shoot a scene outside, so then I had to change it inside in a whole different location. So these are things that I actually enjoy in the process, and we have to rewrite things on the spot, and then even bringing it into post. Sometimes you look at things and you're like, you know what, that flow doesn't work. Maybe I have to change that scene from being earlier to later, or vice versa. You know, so to me, I never get locked into a script. I always keep it open.
So let's discuss something you won't enjoy. What is something that really annoys you on a set that you wish didn't happen?
So one thing for sure that annoys me is when, like I was saying earlier, it's a teamwork and it's a big collaborative effort that we all have to put in. Sometimes, you know, you have 70 plus people working on something together, and then all of a sudden if you see one department or one individual just not doing their part, and no matter what it is, and they're just there just to be there, but they don't want to be there, you know, and that's what hampers all of us. You know, it's you have to be one unit, and if you're not in agreement with something, or you're not, you know, you don't want to be there, you don't like your job, or you can't do your job properly, then to me it's like, speak up and, you know, let everyone know, and that's the fair thing to do, you know, instead of not playing up to the part and bringing us down. So that's happened sometimes in productions, and now, you know, I just try to replace those people, and it can be even a DP, you know, or someone where you get on set and all of a sudden they're a completely different person. It could happen with actors. It could happen with any department head, sometimes producers even, where they become a completely different person. Now it complicates the workflow for everyone else and hampers their work, and now they can't do their best. So to me, that's the one thing that annoys me. But usually we have a solution for it.
So I was doing some research. Said you had a modeling career.
Yes, when I was younger and during my acting days, but that ended around when I was like 14, 15, into high school. Once I realized, okay, I want to be more behind the cameras, that's when, I kind of switched it over. But, I went to modeling school in Cleveland and I used to do a lot of the teen shows and fashion shows and expos, a lot of live shows. So again, part of, you know, always kind of performing in front of an audience.
So I wanted to ask, you do a lot of work in America, obviously. And how is it different is working in Bangladesh as opposed to America? Or is it exactly the same?
No, there's definitely a cultural difference. And with work ethics, they're different. I mean, they have their own professionalism. We have our own, set of rules and professionalism we follow. But at the same time, I would say they work harder because they need to. You know, they don't have some of the luxuries we have here with technology and equipment, which now they're getting more and more recently. But, you know, one of the things that they lack over there is proper education and guidance in our field of work. And again, now it's changing more. But when I started out there, like, you know, 15, 20 years ago, they were still working a lot of things manually. You know, they didn't have a lot of the, you know, technology we have today. So they would figure out different methods and more creative ways to get things done in the same shot. You know, if they didn't have a drone, they'd figure it out with a crane and still make it look like a drone shot, you know, things like that. And even, you know, they do tend to have a lot more people in productions than we do. So there are more help, like more hands. Everyone has assistants, you know, their assistants have assistants. And so, it can be a good and bad thing at the same time, but, there's definitely a difference. But then when you also combine, you know, crew from both sides, then that's where, you know, you can see a lot of magic happen. People from here learn new things. They definitely learn things from us. So, you know, that helps create something unique. And I know a lot of other studios recently have been doing that with Netflix and, you know, just all the studios that are now making more and more films with international crew and blending, you know, both sides together. But that's something I kind of grew up seeing firsthand from the last 20 years.
So in doing my research also, I found out you hosted your own red carpet show for the Oscars.
Yes.
I couldn't
that
find
was,
it.
That was my senior year. I believe it still reruns on Cox TV in Ohio, because I was still in high school at the time, and I had just turned 18, and two of my other friends that were in the program with me, Keith and John, we decided to come out that year for the Oscars, and that was right before I moved to LA. I moved to LA right after I graduated high school. So this was like 5 months before graduation. It was the Oscars, and I was able to acquire some credentials, media credentials through some contacts I had here. And we came out, the three of us came out with all our camera gear and everything. We mapped out like a show that we wanted to do for Cox TV, because at that time we were, you know, producing program for Cox. So we put this, we were out here for like, I believe 5 days, covering, up to like the preparation. It was like a documentary that we put together of the preparations, for the Oscars, a few days, up to the main event, what it takes, what goes on behind the scenes. And then you see like these celebrities come in days before, they're doing their walks, they're doing rehearsal interviews and all kinds of things you don't normally see.
I don't know, back this up. You're telling me that people do rehearsal interviews?
Oh yeah. 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 Absolutely. Even Regis Philbin at that time, we have him interview. Like it's funny, like, Regis Philbin, all the top talk show hosts that even at that time, Ryan Seacrest, all these guys, all the stations, they would go there prior to the actual, you know, event, the Oscars Sunday. It would start like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. They would have different like mock interviews. They would come in, they would do their rehearsals. Then they would also have different events that go on up until the main event that we don't normally see or know about. And you have these stars, they'll always come in, they wear just plain clothes, they're not in their tux or anything, they just show up and they'll do like a rehearsal walk, they'll do rehearsal interviews, and they'll do some real interviews for those events. And then Sunday, the main event happens, so then we were there on Sunday and then kind of saw it all unveil, like what the show really should look like on TV. So it was interesting, and I do have copies of that. I think there's pieces of it online here and there, but it's been mainly shown, and I'm not sure if it still reruns, but I know up until a couple of years ago, it was still being shown on Cox TV locally there in Ohio.
I can't let you go. Who did you interview? Let's hear this. Come on, you're 18 years old. Who did you get to meet?
Oh, man. There were different filmmakers. Del Toro was there at that time for I can't remember that name of the movie from the top of my head, but then you had like the actors from there. You had actors from different international movies at that time that was nominated for an Oscar, like Water. There was a big Bollywood actor, John Abraham, we got to interview. And then there were like other hosts, like Ryan Seacrest. We interviewed Ryan Seacrest. We interviewed Regis Philbin. God bless him, he just passed away, you know, last year. So there were a lot of like legendary, you know, TV personalities, even some filmmakers and actors that we just, and that was like my first time being out in LA as well. I was always working in Ohio or internationally at that time. And to come out to LA and be at the Oscars right there with some of these big, you know, and there were some big producers too. And at that time, like, you know, it was magical. It was like, wow, so this is LA, you know. And then I moved out here 5 months after that. I had made some contacts during doing that show, obviously, that I kept in touch with. And so when I came out here 6 days after graduating high school, I landed, and 2 days later I was already working on it was a smaller gig. It was like a live show, a live concert, where I was coordinating two of the cameras, and it was like a big, you know, multi-20 camera show. But then from there on, I just kept working in production. I did a couple things in front of the camera then, but I shifted more towards just making my own content. And I was in film school at the time. So I was able to utilize my film school as a resource to be able to do a lot of my own content carrying over from high school. It's kind of like the same thing I had in high school, where I had the radio and TV program give me all the resources, cameras, editing labs, you know, friends and people I met there to collaborate with and make my content. And that gave me an advantage in film school, already kind of having the knowledge and skills to edit and use the cameras and know the basics of everything. So I was a little advanced in college, where, you know, every project we would get, and I specifically went to Columbia College Hollywood because they were so hands-on. They gave you a camera from the first week and said, all right, make a short film. Where, you know, I went to UCLA, USC for orientations, just to kind of see what they were like, and they were kind of my choices as well in the beginning. And USC, they don't even give you a camera till your senior thesis film, and even then you're not guaranteed to even direct it. So for me, it was like, no, you know, I know they're prestigious, but it's not about the theory in film. It's more practical. So I wanted to go to more hands-on. So I went to Columbia, and they were great. I mean, you know, they helped me out a lot with giving me the resources and platform out here to be able to continue and making my own content. So that's when I was making a lot of films for festivals. I was making TV pilots, TV shows, you know, even commercials. And then I started getting a lot of clientele being in college, and that carried over, and I just never stopped working since then.
Look at you go. So I'm just thinking here, you're not even 18 yet, or even 19. You're finished high school. You're living your dream. How do your parents react to this? Like, you like, hey, mom, dad, I'm gone. I'm going to LA. I'm going to live my dream. I'm going to be a film director. I'm going to be a cameraman. I'm doing something. You have a good life. Because your parents are on the other side of the country.
Yeah, I mean, they were scared. I'll tell you that much. That's for sure. And now, being a father myself, I definitely understand it. But they were always scared, and they didn't know what to expect, really. I mean, you know, they knew I was doing good things, and they were proud of me. And again, like I said, my dad, he's always been supportive, you know, mentally telling me, you know, he knows. And he told me straight up once, too. He's like, you know, when you wanted to be an actor, I was kind of, you know, worried, like, okay, a lot of times actors really don't make it. But now that you want to be a director, you know, he's like, that makes me more comfortable knowing that, okay, you'll at least make it, you know, at some level. And when you're a director, you know, and everyone thinks, there's a lot of people, most people I you know, came across in the business that wanted to be a filmmaker. Everyone wants to be a director. It's very rarely you see someone want to be an editor or someone want to be, you know, something else. So it's one of those things where everyone wants to do it and they think they can do it until you actually, you know, get to do it. You don't realize how difficult and stressful of a job it really is. It's not fun. I mean, it can be fun if you love it and you're good at it, but it, you know, a lot more people realize that they don't want to be a director within like their first one or two projects. And that's why when I went to film school, I was told at that time, I don't know if it's the same now, but at that time, film schools had the highest dropout rate in the country out of any other schools, you know, like even more than law schools, medical schools, because a lot of people went into film schools thinking, oh, this is going to be glitz and glamour and fun making movies. And then they get there and they see the actual hard work it takes and dedication. Most of them drop out. And I saw that, and by the time I graduated, I saw like it was like around maybe 30% graduation, 30-35% of people actually that we started off with ended up graduating. And then from there, it's like another 5% that actually keep a profession in the field. You know, it's really crazy. But my dad knew, you know, once he saw that I was already directing from a very early age and I loved it and was doing it, he knew, okay, you'll make it as a director. Just stick with it. So, you know, for them, it was scary, but just up until now recently, now it's spread to my whole family where they're all now excited for me. They're all happy. They all know, even up until, you know, a few years ago, I had a lot of family members that was kind of, you know, scared about it, thinking, oh, do you have a guaranteed career? Or, you know, and all my cousins and family members I grew up with, they're all like doctors and engineers and, you know, in businesses. And I'm in this profession that's kind of very foreign to them and most people. But they see my work and they're seeing, you know, how I'm moving forwards. So now it's kind of a different scenario with the family.
So I want to go. You also don't just direct, I mean, you do direct films, but you also do documentaries. I have Holistic Killers and Los Angeles listed. Now, do you approach a documentary totally different than you approach a feature, or is it exactly the same?
Yeah, it's definitely different. It's a whole different medium, but I've always loved documentaries. And one thing I love making documentaries is that for me growing up, I always knew I wanted to be a film director, a narrative and make, you know, entertainment content, but I never saw myself directing or making documentaries, you know, but they always fascinated me. I was one of those kids even growing up. I would not only watch movies, but I would actually watch documentaries of all types. They always fascinated me and I still do. But to me, those are one of those things like, I would watch a documentary. I would say, you know what? That's so different from film. I don't think I could do that. You know, and it takes so much more. I mean, because now you're not playing around with your own imagination and creativeness. You're actually trying to present a real story or something real or someone's life out to the public. But when I did my first, well, in radio and TV, we did a lot of like documentary type shows. So I started getting training from there to doing like news type shows or, you know, like docu style shows. And even the red carpet thing we did when I was 18, we did that. And then when I was about 21, 22, like 2008, 2009, I landed a documentary directorial job that just kind of fell in my lap, which was top priority. And the documentary was so heavy. I mean, it took me 4 years of my life pretty much from the beginning to ending and putting it out and getting the distribution. And it was actually in 2012 in running for a nomination at the Academy Awards that year. But it had a lot of buzz and it became so controversial. And we knew that we wouldn't get nominated. It was too controversial and political. But the doors that were open for me doing that project, I mean, served me well, you know, since then. But at that time, I realized, you know, how hard it really was to make it, but I knew I could do it at that point. I kind of crossed off a box that I never thought I would, because it was similar to kind of like the documentaries that Michael Moore makes, you know, they're very heavy with documents and it's really, you know, overloaded with so much info. And it's not just any info. You have, you're dealing now with the government, you're dealing with, you know, the mafia, the film industry, which the documentary I did, Top Priority, it had stories that dealt with every government agency to every, you know, Hollywood studio and unions. And it is a very controversial piece. I don't know if you've looked that up, but when I did that, I thought back to the documentaries Michael Moore would do. And I remember watching some of his documentaries growing up. And I would think, like, you know what, I could never do that. That's, you know, kudos to him and anyone that makes documentaries. It's like, to me, it was the most difficult type of show. But then once I did it, and I realized how much of, you know, it helped me as even a filmmaker dealing with reality and portraying that on screen. It was actually very beneficial to me as a filmmaker, but at the same time, I realized I had to stop making documentaries at that point because I did not want to be boxed in as a documentary filmmaker or the next Michael Moore. And that's some of the things that even the trades like New York Times and LA Times and Variety, they were writing about it, kind of comparing me to Michael Moore. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to make, you know, sci-fi movies, action movies, you know, fun films that I grew up watching that I wanted to do. So I had to put brakes on it, but moving on from it, I had a different kind of respect and love for making documentaries, because it's just another way of telling stories where you can teach people something about, you know, someone else's life or a case or, you know, something that educational, which, you know, I get personally. I love watching documentaries because they educate me. And so I want to be able to pass that on through documentaries to my audiences. And I try to do a lot of that in my movies as well. Like, they always have some sort of a message for an audience that want to be educated on something, you know.
I do. Okay. I want to let everybody know you've produced a lot of movies and made a lot of movies. So I'm just going to pick I only picked three or four. I just wanted to look briefly, and I just wanted you to give me some opinion on, just because I had people I knew in it. Kill Giggles, sure. You have Vernon Wells in it, who I'm just a huge fan of, Vernon Wells. He's just such a nice guy in person. Yeah. Massive man. And as a kid, I just want to add to everybody, he scared the crap out of me in Rogue Warrior. So how is working with Vernon Wells?
That was one of my favorite movies growing up with Schwarzenegger. Yeah, no, I hear you. That one's actually a real fun film. And I got to say, I wasn't really involved in it during production. I know the director, Jason, he's from North Carolina, and that's where they produced the movie. And Phil Hartman, who you know as well, he's a producer on it, myself and my partner JJ, we actually brought the distribution for it. And we helped them guide to, like, finish the movie. Yes. And we helped, you know. And then now we're actually putting it out. I can't really say which studio, but it's getting a pretty major studio release.
Oh, cool.
Coming up in the next few months. So we just finished it up over the last 6 months, did all the deliverables, and so now it's in the pipeline to get released in 2021. And it's a different take on clown movies, you know. And I did a clown horror movie last year that I produced and edited, and I was part of the distribution on it. Came out by Lionsgate. It was called Clown Fear. And that's like a more stereotypical slasher clown movie type story. But this one, it's kind of reversed. Like, the clowns are now getting murdered by a serial killer. You know, and Vernon Wells plays one of the, like, big clowns. And it's fun. It was actually a refreshing film.
Okay. Well, I have two now that I know you directed because I made notes. I got Commando Military because you have Michael Jamal White, and Michael Paré seems to be the king of these kind of films. Like, he seems to be
21st. Yeah, in The Commando, actually, Michael Pray was supposed to be in it, but he ended up not. We had some scheduling conflicts, so Jeff Fahey took that role of the sheriff in Commando. We had Michael Jai White, who is the hero. We had Mickey Rourke, who is the villain. We had Brendan Fair and Cowboy Cerrone, Donald Cowboy Cerrone, the UFC fighter. So it was a big, good ensemble piece. And that was one of the stories that I was involved in creating. And it was actually a recent film. We just finished it. From story to script, it took a couple months. And then we went into production. And then we just wrapped production about a week and a half ago in New Mexico. Wow. And now it's in post. It's like, you know, already halfway edited. So that was a really fun, exciting film, but it happened really fast, and it was a pretty big film as well, so I'm excited for it. That'll be coming out next year.
Sorry, I missed my notes. Mr. Nine's the one with Mickey Rourke and Michael Paré.
Oh, yes, MR9. So that's another film that's going to happen in a few months. We had a lot of delays due to COVID because it's an international project. We're actually filming parts of it in a majority of it in Greece, and then Bangladesh and Thailand. Originally it was supposed to be South Africa, but and Mauritius. We went out scouting locations last year in those places. But it's a bigger, much, much bigger film. And those are just some of the cast that's been announced, but there's actually some bigger cast involved in that as well that we can't really announce until the top of the year. But that, to me, that film is actually my baby. It's an adaptation from a long-running, it's actually one of the longest-running and biggest novel series in the world. It's the Masood Rana book series from Bangladesh, which is kind of like an Asian James Bond that was created in 1964, inspired from James Bond, you know. But at that time, they didn't have a hero of their own in South Asia. So that was like their way of exploring the world. And so it became a huge hit amongst the youth and teenagers and college students in Bangladesh in 1964. And it took off where they were releasing like 2-3 books every month in the series. And they're like 90-page books, you know, so easy reads. And so kids would just buy them and share them with friends. And then the parents started getting curious, like, what are the kids reading? So then that caught on. So it's a very like multi-generational, fan base. And that I'm really excited about. It's almost like doing a Marvel film because there's like hundreds of millions of followers already on it, spanning from multi-generations, from guys that are 80 years old to 13-year-olds now know about it, you know. And they're still publishing books today since 1964. They've had over like 500-600 books now already published in the series. And they made a movie on the character Masood Rana back in 1974. The first time, and since then, no one else has acquired the rights to make a movie, except, you know, since us. So that was a script that I worked on for about 2 years, and it's adapted, it's ready to go. We've got it cast. We did a lot of pre-production and development on it, but COVID kind of set us back. So since then, I made, you know, 3-4 other films just in that time period, but this one's a little tougher because we have to go in so many different countries, and we can't until things open up.
Okay, last one, because we're getting close to Christmas. How was making your first Christmas film?
The Ace and the Christmas Miracle? That was one of the most pleasurable films I did, I would say, because doing a kid's film, I knew would be fun, but it was just, you know, it was refreshing. And it was relaxing. It was easy, like easy to the sense where, because I'm used to doing, you know, like action and horror and, you know, dramas and intense stories and psychologically effective, you know, pieces. But for this one, it was refreshing with the mind of working with kids and animals and doing a magical story, kind of like a fairy where it's a talking horse, you know, during Christmas time. And John Lovitz is the voice of the talking horse. And that, he was really fun to work with. And we shot the movie in 8 days. It was one of the fastest productions I did, you know, and supposed to be a 10-day schedule. And we shot it right during the pandemic. Actually, we shot it in April. So we cut 10 days to 8 days, and we were able to make it, and the film turned out better than I expected. And I've always loved Christmas films myself, like Home Alone and, you know, Christmas Story. These are films I grew up with. I love Jingle All the Way, like all these different kinds of Christmas movies that I've always enjoyed myself. I've always wanted to make it, even like last year before I knew I would even make this one. I told my wife, I'm like, you know, I can't wait to make a Christmas movie. I look forward to making Christmas movies because, you know, I grew up with watching a lot of Christmas movies that inspired me as a kid. And I know I have to make something for the kids and the younger audiences that I can do the same with. So that allowed me to do it. And it went actually so well. I just got hired to do another Christmas movie.
Oh, right.
Coming up for next year. And it's actually, I can't really say who's all doing it in the studio, but I can say it's Snow White's Christmas movie. So that'll be fun.
Before we let you go, I have to ask everybody three fun questions before they leave my show.
Okay.
So the first one's always everybody gets the same, your favorite film.
Ooh, my favorite film. It's, that's, you know, a tough one for anyone, I'm sure. But if I had to pick my ultimate favorite film, I would say Back to the Future.
Nothing wrong with that. Since you traveled the world, and I would say traveled the world, what's your favorite meal you've had on set?
Favorite meal on set that I never get tired of, I could always have, is in New Mexico. It's funny because I actually had that for breakfast today because I was framing it. We would get these breakfast burritos, and they were very simple and easy because you just pick up the burrito and but New Mexico is known for their burritos, you know, and their chilies and all that. So to me, that was always convenient. And I'm not much of an eater on set, you know, like when I'm in work mode, I don't think about eating or drinking. Like I'll go drink, you know, Gatorades and water to keep hydrated, but, I don't think about eating. I don't get an appetite to eat. So for me, it's a lot easier when I'm like just grabbing something and then eating it as I'm working or going. Cause even through lunch, sometimes I'll just go and start thinking about the next, you know, setups and all that. So for me, and these burritos are so good, I actually never minded having one every day. Like it was like that. And it wasn't like, it was convenient, but at the same time, it was good and filling and had everything in them. So for me, that was good, especially nowadays with COVID. We've changed our menus. Film, you know, lunch before used to be really exciting for people because it was like a buffet and it was like a party. People would always, you know, come hang out. That was like the time to hang out. Now, over the last year, now it's changed where you just get handed something in a box and everyone have to social distance and go off. And so for me, it's that was recently we had that a lot, and I still never got tired of it. So I guess that would be my favorite. And other than that, like Thai food. Whenever we would have Thai food, that was like a feast. You know?
So your last question, your favorite movie poster.
Favorite movie poster would be the Terminator 2 poster, where it was so simple but effective, and it still sticks to my mind today. And when I first saw it, I was really a young kid, just with the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, sitting on the bike, holding the shotgun and with the glasses, Terminator 2. That was, to me, it was cool, you know, and it was very effective. And even today, like, that always sticks to my head, like how simple of a poster that was, but it's one of like the best movies in the world now, you know.
So before we let you go officially, you must have a website you need to promote, T-shirts, DVDs, something to sell. Where can people find your stuff?
I don't have any merchandise that I sell online or anything, but I just, you know, you can find me on Facebook, Asif Akbar, and Instagram. I'm starting to promote that more now. It's Asif Akbar _ filmmaker. That's my Instagram ID. And, you know, a lot of my movies are on Amazon. They can buy, there's actually a book, an Astro, the movie I directed a few years ago. There is a novel that I wrote with my co-writer, Bernard. We do have a book out on that's on Amazon. You can find it's Astro, novel and you type in my name, a C5 part usually pops up. But other than that, I don't have like a personal website where I sell my merchandise.
Well, thank you for your time, and I'll see you again soon.
And thank you, Simon. Yeah, I look forward to it. Have a great one.